Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Miceli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. Well, this week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Nahar Barzev, Deputy Director of the International Vaccine Access Center at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Dr. Barzev is collaborating with research scientists around the world, all working towards development of a viable vaccine for COVID-19. He talks about moving into phase 3 trials for some leading candidates and the huge challenge it'll be to get it to the marketplace. Lori Robertson also checks in. The managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Nahar Barzev from Johns Hopkins, Bloomberg School of Public Health, here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Nahar Barzev, Deputy Director of the International Vaccine Access Center at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. He's a pediatric infectious disease physician and statistical epidemiologist whose research is focused on how to maximize vaccine benefits for low-resource, high-mortality areas of the world. He recently co-authored a piece in the British journal, The Lancet, on the current race to develop a vaccine for COVID-19.
Dr. Barzev is a principal director on a number of research protocols at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and he's a founding member of Immunizing Pregnant Women and Infants Network. He led the vaccines research group at the Malawi Liverpool Wellcome Trust Clinical Research Program and was a member of the Malawi National Immunization Technical Advisory Group. Dr. Barzev, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Dr. Barzev, I think it's fair to say that Johns Hopkins has really been out in front of this pandemic, building a robust scientific framework to address COVID-19. And the world obviously is waiting for any positive news about the vaccine. And in the recent Lancet article, you offered some optimistic analysis of the phase 1 and 2 clinical trials, but you also cautioned there may be some potential roadblocks ahead. But I'm wondering, what's involved in a phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 of vaccine development? And then if you could tell us why you're both optimistic and concerned about the development of the vaccine.
A phase 1 study looks at safety in a small number of people and often tries to, usually is a first in human trial after some animal work or other work that precedes it. And it tries to generate an immune response at varying doses. Phase 2 similarly tries to get a little bit more detail on the right dose of an intervention, and again, looking at safety, and usually in the case of vaccines, at immunogenicity. In other words, does the vaccine induce an immune response in the recipient? A phase 3 trial is a whole order of magnitude different. It's a much bigger trial, and in the case of COVID-19, will be very much bigger. And it looks to see whether the vaccination reduces the infection itself, reduces the disease from infection and infection, whether the vaccine actually provides clinical protection. Now, there are a lot of reasons to be optimistic. First of all, we've seen a really big global effort. There's funding that's available to drive that effort as well. And we're seeing a broad range of vaccine candidates, which is really great because many will fail. And so having depth of field is important. But as you say, there are hurdles to come. The key one is always with any vaccine, but particularly now, the question of vaccine safety is crucially important and will need to be addressed in ongoing studies. And even once we have a vaccine, we need to make sure that its distribution is equitable, that it's affordable, that it comes at a reasonable cost. And all of these are challenges yet to come.
Well, Dr. Barzev, you've been on the front lines of vaccine development for years, but you have this unique challenge of we've got to get to safety, and at the same time, we know the people most affected by COVID-19 have been vulnerable, particularly members of some minority groups and people with other coexisting chronic illnesses. So maybe you could share with our listeners some of the unique challenges that are encountered into developing a vaccine that will be safe and will be safe for, in particular, those populations who are really at most risk from the disease itself.
So there are a number of challenges in developing a COVID-19 vaccine, given that we don't really even know yet what level protective immunity is. We don't know how much antibody we need to have in the body to prevent us getting infected. We've seen from trials that there's good immune response, and that's great. We've also seen T-cell mediated or cellular mediated response, and that's even better. But we'll have to see. The phase threes will really tell us. The other challenging thing is that the risk group, as you've alluded to, are older adults. And older adults, particularly older adults, have a phenomenon where they don't respond immunologically as well as younger adults and as or indeed children. We call that phenomenon immune senescence. And so developing a vaccine that's particularly effective in older adults can be quite challenging. It may require more than one dose. It may require specific adjuvants or other formulations that are unique for adults. The phase three trials are going to include adults up to the age of 85. Uh-huh. Some specific groups around the country and elsewhere overseas working on specific older adult vaccines, and there may be a range of products out there in the end for that. Other problems are going to be generating long-lasting immunity. We want immunity to be there for a year after vaccines and several years after. But underlying all of this beyond the vaccinology really is the demographic question. Till now, we've had a total of 6 people of African descent in the Moderna trial and the Oxford trial, for example. And, you know, that's really a tiny number. Yeah. So the phase three trials are going to have to be in the tens of thousands and be as inclusive as possible so that we can infer both safety and efficacy in these population groups. Because the people who want to receive the vaccine in the end want to know that it's safe for them. And so we won't know that unless they're in the studies.
We're heading into this phase three. We might see, I've heard the number up to 30,000 people, obviously the ability to reach out to a much broader and diverse population. And we happen to be part of the initial IRB process for the All of Us initiative at NIH. You know, Dr. Collins really set out to create a study that really represented our whole country. And we here in the United States have a very diverse population, as you know. Is there sort of a custodian of these phase threes that say, here are the corridors you should be in terms of representation, or is Moderna and others allowed to sort of determine that on their own?
One of the advantages of doing things in a somewhat more overlapping way is that in the routine course of events, the company that wants to produce a product for the market in those kinds of capitalistic terms, if you like, goes off and does its work and then gathers all the data and presents it to an independent regulator to review. Here, because we want things to be successful first time, because we as a society can't afford to lose time, regulators are participating, and not in the production of the data, obviously, they need to retain independence, but they are already laying out what trials really need to look like. And part of that comes from societal expectations. I think scientists are just human beings. And even though the methods that we use are scientific, the questions that we ask are often based not on science, but on issues or on societal issues. So the more we argue and the more we advocate for inclusive trials, pragmatic trials, the more I think those will occur. And what we want are trials that are pragmatic so that we can infer from those trials to what the real world result will be. Mm-hmm. So we don't want the perfect specimens in the trials. We want everybody in the trials. Mm-hmm. Now, the All of Us example that you gave, you know, that's a great example of the breadth of data that are required. And I think it's important to understand that data are useful in a couple of ways. First of all, obviously they tell us what we can know, but they only tell us those things if we measure them. Mm-hmm. Vaccine trials are a bit different to clinical trials. A clinical trial, let's imagine a new treatment for cancer. Well, I need to go to patients who have cancer. They're already sick, and perhaps they'd be willing to tolerate some degree of risk to cure their cancer with a potential cure. A vaccine trial isn't like that. A vaccine trial is given to healthy people, and it's given potentially with a view that it would be given to all the target population, all people, in order to prevent a condition, not to cure an existing condition. So the bar of safety has to be much, much higher. I mean, we really have to demonstrate safety in vaccine trials even more than in usual therapeutic clinical trials. And as in all trials, but particularly here, the individual who's participating in the trial has to be fully informed and has to consent. That's the foundation of ethical conduct of trials. And the reason for that is that you need voluntary participation. You know, it's not just with the company that makes the product. Now, this is a different kettle of fish. We need all of humanity to come together and participate in these activities so that we can have a vaccine for their communities as soon as possible.
Well, I wonder if you could comment on another, I think a concern that we've had that maybe there's other crises in the making here, and that is that we saw the tremendous drop-off in people getting primary care at all, and with it, a real drop-off in childhood immunizations over this course of time. And we have the flu season coming up, right? And we're telling older people, you know, avoid crowds, and yet we have the huge potential for the risk of people not getting the influenza vaccine. I'm really curious, how are we gonna message this for the fall to get people to come and get that flu vaccine, even when we're telling people avoid crowds?
Sure, so look, there are good data already available from around the world. I mean, in the US in the first quarter of 2020, at least some states have reported a reduction in childhood vaccination coverage of, you know, over 20%. And an analysis World Health Organization conducted showed that at least in 68 countries, which covered about 400 million under five children, coverage reduced between 15 to 50% in some settings. And that's work that was done here at Johns Hopkins. So, you know, these are real crises. I don't want to even wait till we have another measles crisis.
Right.
The fact that we have low coverage is a crisis. And it's not just children who are at risk of reduced childhood vaccination rates, it's the rest of us. We've seen adult cases of measles because of reductions in childhood vaccination. So, you know, the key issue is that we really have to ensure access to everybody. Use this really as an opportunity to rebuild the vaccine systems in a way that's robust and flexible, adaptive and responsive to community needs, to family needs. You know, I've seen in places around the world that vaccinators really make a big effort to reach every child. If they go far on the back of a bike, but then they have to carry the bike on their back to cross the mud. And so that kind of flexibility and outreach has to happen even in high-income settings. You know, we need to value what vaccines are. In terms of your question about flu, I think it's a great opportunity to have a dress rehearsal for a COVID vaccine. Mm-hmm. If we build the right kind of mechanisms to reach all older adults with vaccines and flu vaccines, I mean, before the coming winter, and make them available and engage with communities to make that happen, we can learn a lot from that. We can learn how we can reach optimally older adults, and that would be great lessons to then implement when it comes to the availability of a COVID-19 vaccine.
We're speaking today with Dr. Noor Barzev, Director of the International Vaccine Access Center at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. He recently co-authored a piece in the British journal, The Lancet, on the current race to develop a vaccine for COVID-19. You know, Dr. Barzev, you and your colleagues at Johns Hopkins recently held a press event addressing the race to a vaccine, which you feel could be ready for some kind of deployment next year, but you say the federal, state, and local governments must start acting now to develop a comprehensive strategy to prepare the public on the need to participate on the COVID-19 vaccination. I think we also have some of the challenges for people who are opposed to vaccine, but we're still seeing a very disjointed message out of the White House on some of the basics, use of masks, talking about proven remedies versus unproven remedies. So what kind of messaging would you recommend?
Look, I think it's important to remember that we're seeing a brand new and we're learning a huge amount very quickly. And what we're actually seeing is science unfolding, maybe blossoming in real time with all of its, you know, glorious uncertainties. We don't know everything in science, and that's good. That's what science is about. It's about exploring the unknown. And our obligation is to provide as best available data, the best cutting edge science to the population as quickly and definitively as we can, but also humbly to admit what we don't know and to be prepared to change course if new evidence emerges. And the hydroxychloroquine example, which perhaps you were alluding to or others, is a good one. I mean, we thought that, you know, there was some suggestion, there was some evidence, and then the evidence was undone. And so the messaging was changed, and that's okay. Like the public maybe feels uncomfortable about that because people in our society, we live in this kind of a post, well, let me just say like this, that people put a lot of store on what science has to say, and science seems to be the doyen of some kind of objective truth. And that's not the case. Science is just human beings exploring the unknown. So I think as long as we're clear about that, but our messages have to be empathic and they have to be real, you know, with their feet on the ground, they have to know what communities are feeling. They shouldn't be patronizing, they shouldn't pontificate. It's especially true for vaccine safety. You know, just saying vaccines are safe, the saying that vaccines are safe doesn't make them safe. The evidence that vaccines are safe is hard won, and it's challenging to get, and it takes a lot of effort and diligence. So I think the best way to speak to people is to be frank, open, honest, listen as much as you speak, you know, speak with people, not to or at people, and listen to their concerns. If people have concerns about vaccine safety, so do I. I don't want to give an unsafe vaccine to my aging mother. You know, I want to be able to give her a safe vaccine. You know, we're all in the same boat, the scientific community, the vaccine community, and the general community. And I think that's the foundation in which we would need to discuss with people rather than message at people.
Well, let me ask you to address another, what I just see as enormous challenge. And we've never had anything in my lifetime that I can remember that we've said we would want to get this to every person on the planet or as close to that as we can. And now we're talking about a manufacturing process of just like enormous proportions. And then we're talking about a logistics, if you will, operation of enormous proportions. And I appreciate the point about using our flu clinics this year as a kind of a dress rehearsal, but this is on a factor a few hundred times larger. And I'm really curious, at Johns Hopkins, is there somebody in charge of scenario planning, thinking about just the scale of what we are all going to try and accomplish when a vaccine becomes available?
There's not going to be one solution that's suitable for all locations. The detail has to be focused ground up. So we have to be listening to what people want and understanding how countries prioritize. For example, the COVAX facility, which is a combination of CEPI, which the Pandemic Preparedness Organization, Gavi, which whose remit is to deliver vaccines globally, and the WHO, conducted 136 country consultations to really understand where countries are at, what their planning requirements are. It's one thing to give a country a whole bunch of doses, but it's quite another if they don't have the cold chain capacity. I mean, where am I going to store my vaccines? When new vaccines were introduced in 2011 and 2012, for example, in Malawi, there was a lot of very proactive planning by the Ministry of Health, to their very great credit. They thought about this very carefully in advance, and they built the cold chain capacity right through the system to accommodate just the storage of the physical vaccine. So that has to all happen in advance. There's no point having a vaccine and then not being able to deliver it. And what we're doing here at Johns Hopkins and the International Vaccine Access Center is developing the tools that countries can use, that the National Immunization Technical Advisory Groups can use to implement and to plan for implementation and then delivery. Every country will have different priorities. There needs to be priorities, as mentioned, around safety and around financing. There's going to be ethical questions about which population and subpopulation should be prioritized first. There are questions about demand and hesitancy, and how do we address those things? It's, again, I can try to deliver, but if the population doesn't want to receive, then I need to address that in advance. So all of these things are facets of a sort of a complex matrix, a Rubik's Cube, if you like, that every country has to think about, implement, and then evaluate. Just as an example for, you know, let's say healthcare workers in the United States, that probably will be in the first round prioritized. They probably could be vaccinated through their places of work. Older adults, as I said before, we need to think about the infrastructure for delivery. But think about people with comorbid conditions. How do we even identify them? You know, maybe there's a diabetes registry or whatever, but how do we identify everybody who's obese or everybody who's got high blood pressure? How do we reach them? You know, these are very complex questions.
Right.
And the question of resistance or hesitancy, again, we need to address that right at the outset throughout the whole process with inclusion, openness, honesty, you know, and I mean the large bulk of people in the middle who share my vaccine safety concerns, the, you know, not extremists, but normal people have reasonable concerns, and they need to be engaged in the process in order to be successful in delivery. But we are hopeful that some of these new vaccine products and vaccine platforms are scalable. We'll get through those hurdles. They're not insurmountable. And, you know, it's good to know that some of these companies that are investing at risk, it's got to be said, with not knowing that the vaccine will be definitively efficacious, are investing the infrastructure that's required to produce these vaccines to massive scale, billions of doses.
Dr. Barzev, we've been fortunate to have a number of thought leaders who joined us recently, Dr. Eric Topol and Dr. Zeke Emanuel. And it seemed to be some unanimity on one hand, the lack of federal leadership in this really incredible time of crisis, the muzzling of the CDC that's been going on. But they also marvel at the accelerated level of scientific collaboration that's occurring really all over the globe. And as you sort of look at all the investment that's going in, what are the collateral discoveries might be hastened or unleashed because of this really massive scientific endeavor?
Yeah, look, I mean, there's always reasons to be optimistic, and especially now, there are many reasons. I think the science is cutting edge. We've shown ourselves as a community, a scientific community, that we can really band together and move things forward. The vaccine platforms that are being developed are novel. Obviously, we need to demonstrate their safety and effectiveness, but they're not just novel, but they're potentially adaptable for the future needs. And that's really important, because this isn't going to be our last pandemic. You know, we're fortunate that this is a very infectious pandemic, but with relatively modest mortality. If we were to combine in 50 years from now or in 15 years from now, a coronavirus pandemic with the infectivity of this one and the mortality of the MERS one that happened in 2012, you know, that would be medieval, the Black Plague all over again. So we need vaccine platforms that can be developed quickly and rapidly and adapt to new emerging threats. And that's happening right now. And that will become normal going forward. And the other opportunity is to heal ourselves as a society, as we build better health systems, responsive health systems, and inclusive health systems. More than the science, it's our ability to gather together with all of our differences and all of our divisions to really celebrate that division. Those divisions as just all many parts of a unified whole that we're healing and strengthening in response to this pandemic.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Naor Barzev, the Deputy Director of the International Vaccine Access Center at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Learn more about their important work on COVID-19 by going to www.jhsph.edu/IVAC or go to jhsph.edu/COVID-19. Dr. Barzev, we want to thank you for your commitment to advancing this vital area of scientific discovery. Now, for providing a sober but, I think, optimistic voice in this ongoing crisis, and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks so much for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo made the over-the-top claim that if the Trump administration, quote, had done its job, the virus wouldn't come here. Cuomo pointed to a study that suggested government officials could have better mitigated the spread of the coronavirus in New York City, but it didn't say they could have stopped it. The governor referred to a study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in saying, quote, Trump is to blame for the virus coming to New York. The study found that genome sequencing of positive coronavirus cases in New York City mostly resembled sequences in Europe, but the U.S. government's travel restrictions on Europe were implemented too late to mitigate the introduction of the virus. Those restrictions were implemented on March 13. By March 15, community transmission was widespread. But the CDC didn't say that Trump is to blame for the coronavirus coming to New York, as Cuomo suggests. The research on international travel limitations shows they can delay the path of the spread of diseases, but do little to contain them. The CDC report used specimens collected by the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene at 6 hospital emergency rooms from patients with influenza-like symptoms who had tested negative for influenza. The CDC found 36 tested positive for the coronavirus and found the positive specimens mostly resembled the genetic sequences of the virus circulating in Europe. The study suggests the virus spreading in New York City in March largely wasn't affected by the federal government's restrictions on travel from China. Limited testing availability and strict testing criteria harmed the ability to detect cases and slow the spread. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week,
Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. September is Suicide Prevention Month, and it's of particular interest to the Veterans Administration. An estimated 22 veterans per day are taking their own lives in what's being described as a post-war suicide crisis. With a lack of behavioral health clinicians available for every veteran who's experiencing difficulty, the VA has launched a campaign aimed at all Americans who know veterans who may be struggling to be aware that they can make a difference just by reaching out. It's called the Power of One campaign, the idea that one person reaching out to one veteran in a caring manner can make a difference.
The power of one small action, one conversation, or one phone call can make a difference in the life of a veteran going through a difficult time. For free 24/7 confidential support, call the Veterans Crisis Line or the Military.
According to Dr. Caitlin Thompson, Deputy Director of VA Suicide Prevention Program, it takes only a moment and just one small act can start them down the path to getting the support they need. The VA has launched a new suicide prevention hotline. It's now collaborating with community groups across the country to prepare them to better address the needs of these veterans, many of whom don't know how to ask for the help they need. Veterans, service members, and anyone concerned about them can call the Veterans Crisis Line, 1-800-273-8255. They can chat online at veteranscrisisline.net/chat or send a text to 838-255, even if they're not registered with the VA or enrolled in VA healthcare. All Veterans Crisis Line resources are optimized for mobile devices. A dedicated program aimed at reaching out to veterans across the country, empowering community groups and individuals to find ways of offering support to getting veterans the help they need before it's too late. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.